Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, so maybe the Greek debt dilemma has been successfully sidestepped after all. European officials were sounding optimistic today that the next aid slice for Greece could still be paid out this month. Now, on to the next domino, and this one is threatening to fall with a much bigger thud. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for starting your week with us on this seventh day of November, a day that Greece's two main political parties spent negotiating over who will be the country's new prime minister. And Eurozone finance ministers are trying to rule out any more rude surprises by demanding both Greek parties co-sign on their commitment to tough austerity measures. Even before that's all tied up, concern is focusing on another European country that's too big to bail. Italy's prime minister is defying calls to resign, and now that country threatens to overtake Greece as the main threat to Europe's stability. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the overseas circuit with us. Greetings, Stephen.
Hello, Bob.
So we meet again for another chapter in this seemingly endless saga. Why is Italy so significant in this Eurozone debt crisis?
This is the big one, Bob. It's the third largest economy in the Eurozone after Germany and France, and it has the world's third biggest national debt, $2.6 trillion, $300 billion of which it has to repay or roll over next year. If it can't, there's going to be real trouble. The European bailout fund isn't big enough to bail it out. The Europeans have promised to increase that fund, but they're struggling to do so. So if Italy slides into default, it could easily bring down the European single currency, the euro.
Now you're making this sound pretty ominous. Is there really any danger of Italy defaulting? I mean, surely it has a much stronger economy than Greece.
Yes, it has. And in fact, Italian individuals and households have not borrowed up to the hilt. They're much less indebted than their European counterparts. The problem is, though, with its public debt, which is huge, as I've said, and doubts about the ability of the government of Silvio Berlusconi to get that debt under control. Investors are demanding higher and higher rates of interest to hold Italian government bonds. And today, the government's cost of borrowing in Rome hit the kind of levels that drove Portugal, Greece and Ireland to seek a bailout.
Now, forgive me if you've heard this before, but this could be a big week in this story. Some key events coming up?
That's right. On Wednesday, a team from the European Commission arrives in Rome to check the books, to find out how much progress the Berlusconi government has been making in cutting public spending and reforming the economy. But tomorrow, there's potentially an even more explosive event. The government faces a vote on its public finances, which could be followed by a vote of confidence. Berlusconi could very easily lose that vote tomorrow and could be forced to resign.
You know, it's really looking like the job of leading a country in the Eurozone is quite a precarious occupation right now, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, this crisis has already toppled governments in Portugal and Ireland, now Greece. Voters have been punishing their leaders because of the austerity that they've been doling out. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, faces an election campaign within 6 months, and he's already suffering badly in the polls. Sarkozy is said to be terrified that if Greece defaults, French banks will lose a fortune and will have to be bailed out by the government, and that will cost the French government its AAA credit rating. The word is that the French people couldn't stand such a humiliation and would therefore give Sarkozy a real kicking in the presidential election. So, yes, this crisis seems to be claiming political scalps across Europe.
And you'll be heading to Italy to give us some first-hand accounts. We'll be looking forward to that.
I'll talk to you then.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Before Silvio Berlusconi became the Prime Minister of Italy, he was a billionaire media mogul. So when he wanted to announce today that he wasn't stepping down as Prime Minister, he used Facebook. "The rumors of my resignation," he wrote, "are unfounded." One line on Facebook was enough to move the markets in Europe, but Marketplace's Steve Henn wondered how effective it'll be in the end.
Why would a man who owns his own TV networks make a major political announcement on Facebook? Scott Galloway is a social media expert at NYU. He says Berlusconi is famously obsessed with youth.
Facebook has become the corporate equivalent of skinny jeans, in that anybody who uses Facebook thinks that they look younger, hipper, and more relevant.
Galloway says there's a time and a place to be hip, and this ain't it.
I don't think you would have seen Obama or Merkel decide to make this sort of decision and announce it on Facebook.
Okay, maybe not. But Alan Weber, a social media consultant at the Altimeter Group, says there can be an upside to this approach.
You could reach so many people with one message, and it was so much faster, so much more direct than anything else.
But Weber says when leaders go social in a crisis, it's a bit like pulling back the curtain on The Wizard of Oz. You might not like what you see. Right now, global investors don't want an Italian leader fiddling with his Facebook page. They want somebody who can lead the country and balance the budget. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Wall Street rallied out of the red before the close. Details when we do the numbers. Even if you don't know college football, you've probably heard about Penn State. Today, anyway, a former assistant football coach is facing charges of sexually abusing 8 boys over 15 years. 2 officials at the university are charged with failing to report the abuse and lying to a grand jury. And investigators are looking into how the school handled the accusations, which could tell us a lot about just how big a business college football has become. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
In State College, Pennsylvania, football is a very big deal.
It's the thing that the town is known for. There is a good university there, but when you say Penn State to the average American, they're immediately going to say football, Joe Paterno, Nittany Lions.
That's Murray Sperber. He teaches classes on sports in education at UC Berkeley. Joe Paterno is the legendary coach of the Penn State football team, the Nittany Lions. Sperber says he's known for running a clean program in a scandal-ridden sport. Paterno hasn't been accused of wrongdoing. Jerry Sandusky, the accused former assistant coach, was once considered Paterno's heir apparent.
Something like this really contradicts a lot of the mystique around the program.
Some believe football has become too important to universities, eclipsing other sports. Scott Rosner is with the Wharton Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. At Penn State, football brings in millions of dollars from ticket sales, alumni donations, and the Big Ten television contract. But all told, Rosner says athletics makes up maybe 5% of the university's revenue.
It's a very small slice of the pie. The better way to think about an athletic program is as the front porch of a university. It's the first thing that many people see, hear, and associate with a university.
The accusations that emerged over the weekend make that front porch a little less inviting. Berkeley's Murray Sperber says what determines a football program's success is winning or losing. And he says Penn State's having a pretty good year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If there's one thing billionaire investor Warren Buffett is known for, it's not changing things up too often. He likes his steak every day from the same diner, and he famously invests for the long haul. But in the latest earnings report, we learned his Berkshire Hathaway invested nearly $24 billion last quarter, the most in over a decade. When Buffett shakes things up, he can cause an avalanche of copycat investing. Solution? Just tuck some of those investments away from the public eye, with the blessing of regulators. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
You ever get the feeling that someone's watching you? Imagine you're Warren Buffett.
Whose every move is watched. You know, every time he invests money, somebody thinks he must know something.
That's Jeff Kern, a partner with the law firm Shepard Mullin. Buffett controls the influential conglomerate Berkshire Hathaway. It owns stock in everything, from insurance companies to railroads to Coca-Cola. Regulations require powerful money managers to disclose their investments, but the SEC can grant exceptions, says Paul Hastings' partner David Hirth.
In my experience, it's unusual.
Not so for Buffett, who doesn't always like to show his full hand. He has a good track record of getting privacy, says University of Maryland professor David Cass.
This is not unusual. It's at least 50% of the time, and this has been going on for years.
Buffett often buys and sells big blocks of stock that could move the market, says Cass.
He may be getting special treatment, largely, because there are probably thousands of investors who would follow along and just make similar purchases or sales.
Michael Yoshikami, a portfolio manager, owns shares of Berkshire Hathaway. He says he uses Buffett's public list of investments as a smell test to tell him if he's on the right investing track.
I think it is a bit disheartening that even Berkshire Hathaway at this point is moving towards less transparency.
Berkshire Hathaway didn't comment. Buffett has a new money man, Todd Combs, and a lot of investors want to know what he's thinking. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This week, the Senate is likely to approve a tax credit for employers who hire military veterans. The proposal is part of the president's American Jobs Act. Companies that hire long-term unemployed vets would be eligible for as much as $5,600 to help pay that vet's salary for a year. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports incentives like this only go so far when creating a job.
The unemployment rate for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan is above 12%, and President Obama says that doesn't make sense.
You know what? If you can save a life on the battlefield, then you can save a life in an ambulance. If you can oversee a convoy or millions of dollars of assets in Iraq, you can help a business back home manage their supply chain or balance their books.
But employers say the president's one-time $5,600 tax credit doesn't go far enough when costs like relocation and training can run tens of thousands of dollars. And that's not to mention the long-term commitment of salaries, payroll taxes, health, and retirement benefits.
It's the long haul that you got to look at.
Stephen Kapp is the CEO of Laser Age Technology in Waukegan, Illinois. He says the tax incentive isn't enough to create a new job.
It seems to me the reason they're putting these tax credits is they're trying to get people to hire extra people. That just makes no sense to me because this day and age, you don't have extra employees.
But Richard Derrickson, the CEO of Hiwassee Manufacturing in Arkansas, says his stamped metal business is improving.
With this kind of an incentive, that would certainly make me cast a favorable eye at the Air Force base that's just a quarter of a mile down the road from us.
In a slack economy, both businessmen said no one will take advantage of the tax credit unless they need a new worker anyway. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As we head into the season of giving, here's a story about people trying to do social good by turning the nonprofit model on its head. There's a new crop of social entrepreneurs getting their MBAs and raising venture capital to create for-profit companies devoted to solving such problems as deforestation, disease, and poverty. They're idealistic and hard-nosed. But as Alex Goldmark reports, saving the world these days is an increasingly competitive business.
Jamie Jones is the director of the Social Enterprise Program at Northwestern's Kellogg School. She says so many students are flocking to her program that enrollment in the business school's main social enterprise class has tripled, and she's had to offer new courses to meet student demand.
There's a clear interest here and change here, and what you really see is the old model of people making their money and waiting till the end of their lives to give it away is really not acceptable to this new generation.
Chicago native Yuensia Ding belongs to that generation. She's young and wants to make her social impact while working, not after. Ding started as a management consultant, but it was a volunteer experience that gave her a taste of using those strategy skills for a good cause. At a bar with a group of like-minded graduate students, she's explaining that come-to-social-enterprise moment and why it motivated her to go to Wharton.
So business principles can really make a difference in the world. That could be in sustainability, that could be in international development, that could be in so many different places.
Since Ding arrived at Wharton, the social enterprise club there more than doubled to 300 students. Other schools report an even bigger surge.
I think, if anything, we could be headed toward a social entrepreneurial bubble if we're not in one already.
Andrew Zolli heads Pop Tech and evaluates hundreds of organizations for his social innovation fellowship and incubator. He says a host of hasty startups are cluttering the sector now, and many of the aspiring world changers don't understand the challenges.
It's not easier than traditional business. It's harder. You know, no one changes the world in a drive-by. No one tweets their way to climate change.
Zolli says relatively few social entrepreneurs will succeed. One company that has is D-Lite. Almost 2 billion people worldwide live without electricity. Mainly they use dangerous and dim kerosene lamps. So D-Lite has developed a line of safe and affordable substitutes.
This one is our newest product. It's called the D-Lite S1.
That's D-Lite co-founder Ned Tozen. After the design breakthrough at Stanford Business School, Tozen and a partner raised venture capital and moved to India and China to be closer to their clients and suppliers. He says that legwork is what helped them to sell more than 1 million lights in 40 countries.
It's a huge market. There are other companies now that are starting to come up with other solar lighting products, but the reality is our main competitor is kerosene.
So what about that social enterprise bubble that Andrew Zolli predicts? D-Light's investors aren't worried. Raj Kundra of the Acumen Fund has seeded dozens of social startups, and he welcomes competition.
We're not at all scared or concerned about that. We think that multiple participants trying to solve a problem will lead to more innovation.
Even if it means a lesson in failure for many of those aspiring world changers. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Coming up, baguettes in France, dispensed on the go.
There's a little bit of crustiness, a kind of, and you can hear it. There's not the resonance of a drum I'd like to hear. It's too flat.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street managed to find positive ground despite more twists and turns in the European debt drama. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 85 points, almost 0.75%, to close at 12,068. The Nasdaq picked up 9 points, 0.33%, to close at 2695. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.33%, to settle at 1261. Investors applauded DreamWorks Animation after Puss in Boots was number one at the box office for the second week in a row. Shares pawed their way, almost 12% higher. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases job openings and labor turnover data for September. The Society for Human Resource Management convenes a conference, Work-Life Focus 2012 and Beyond. It looks at strategies for creating more effective and flexible workplaces. And his job is to taste food and chew people out on television. Chef and TV personality Gordon Ramsay turns 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Here's a significant number to ponder, 16%. That's the rate of Americans living in poverty, according to an alternate way of measuring the problem released by the Census Bureau today. The official poverty level is nearly 1 percentage point lower. Under this new measure, a few groups, kids for example, appear to fare a little better, but poverty rates for the elderly shoot up significantly. All of which might be fascinating for policy wonks, but as Sarah Gardner reports, the new reading doesn't change anything for the folks behind the numbers.
Mama, where's all the utensils and stuff?
I don't know. What are you doing?
42-year-old Leilani Smith, her teenage daughter, and 9-year-old son are navigating a new one-bedroom apartment in Pasadena, California. They got here thanks to a local charity that helped them after Smith lost her part-time job and the family became homeless.
This apartment was considered inexpensive. It's $950 for a one-bedroom.
Without a stove or refrigerator.
So we do have to eat out to get hot meals, and that's expensive. And sometimes I might eat once a day.
Right now, Smith and her kids are living off unemployment and the disability benefit for her daughter's bipolar disorder. That adds up to a little over $18,000 a year, slightly above the official poverty line for a household of three. But this new supplemental poverty measure takes into account the higher cost of living in places like L.A. and expenditures like childcare and out-of-pocket medical bills, the kind of things Leilani Smith likes to call overhead.
You have your utility bills, and then you have your house items, and then your kids' childcare, gas.
But the new measure also takes into account benefits that relieve poverty, like food stamps and tax credits. Smith's family would probably slide below the poverty line under this newer measure, especially because they live in an expensive city. But on a practical level, it doesn't matter. That's because government assistance will still be pegged, at least for now, to the official poverty measure, not this supplemental one. Census Bureau statistician Chuck Nelson.
We think it's a measure people should look at, but it still is a work in progress.
Census Bureau economist Kathleen Short says policymakers can glean valuable information from it, like, are food stamps working? Short says today's data shows the poverty rate would jump 1.7% without that government program.
So food stamps have been an effective way to pull people across the poverty line.
But living above that line, argue social workers, doesn't necessarily mean you're not struggling to meet basic needs. Many of the working poor are simply making hard choices, like whether to pay for medicine or gas for the car. Or they're doing without what most of us take for granted. Leilani Smith says she one day hopes to buy her kids something they've bugged her about for years, a home computer. In Pasadena, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Parisians are pretty much used to buying things from vending machines. Train tickets, condoms, bottled water, chocolate. Sometimes all four in the same evening. But there's something that the French are especially famous for, which doesn't really lend itself to being stocked up for later sale. In fact, since the use of preservatives is banned by law in this particular product, it tends to go stale very quickly. But where there's a will, there's a way, and one enterprising Frenchman has figured out a way. In Paris, John Lawrenson has the story.
This is the sound of bread dropping out of Paris's first baguette vending machine. It's a sleek design with a touchpad screen, kind of looks like an ATM. But inside, there's a little bakery.
Ah, yeah, it is. Nice and hot. Okay, very good. Okay, we got...
Very hot.
Hot and fresh, especially important for French bread, which is usually rock hard at the end of a single day. Jean-Louis Hecht, the man who invented the baguette machine, has been baking them all his working life at his boulangerie in a small town in eastern France. Then one day he had a baking revelation.
I know all my customers. Some of them, when they'd forgotten to come before closing time, used to ring my bell because I lived above the bakery. And I'd come down, have a bit of a chat, and sell them a baguette. But when I went back up, my wife used to complain that the dinner was cold, and you're never there, nag, nag, nag. So one day I said, don't worry, I'm going to build a machine.
And he had a clever idea. He knew partially cooked dough stays fresh 3 days. So why not pack the machine with baguettes which are only two-thirds cooked? The machine completes the baking as the baguettes get near the front of the line to be sold. American student Megan Stahl has come from a different neighborhood with her friends just to use this machine.
It's a great idea.
You think you could use this sort of machine, yeah?
Yeah.
You don't like the idea of going into a traditional boulangerie, bonjour madame, all that kind of stuff?
Well, yeah. Depends on if I feel good about my French that day. This is easier in the middle of the night.
That's true.
Which is when I usually want a baguette.
The machine might be good for night owls, but experts are skeptical about the quality.
There's a little bit of crustiness, a kind of, and you can hear it, yeah. a residual crustiness, not really a song. There's not the resonance of a drum I'd like to hear. It's too flat.
Steve Kaplan is perhaps the world's leading authority on French bread.
It's just too insufficiently developed, so it doesn't give me the tactile pleasure that I want to have, because bread, you know, is one of the few things we eat without the intermediation of utensils. So it really is something very sensual to the hands. So let me open it up and see what we get.
Though his initial reaction to the baguette I'd brought him to test was that it was an ugly mother, his final judgment was that it was less awful than he feared. Strong praise indeed. Not good enough, however, to threaten France's network of bakeries, the densest bread distribution network in the world.
Bakeries are places of sociability. In France, there are 32,000. The bakeries help to forge, to weave the social bond in France. They are important institutions. They're like cafes and churches and tribunals. They help to really construct the landscape of French ontology, of French being, of French identity.
Baguette machine man Jean-Louis Hecht says traditional boulangeries have to adapt or die. He hopes his baguette maker will catch on just like ATM machines have caught on. He'll install and rent a baguette machine for the cost of 40 baguettes a day. Hecht says if a baker can sell more than that number out of the machine, he'll be making money, whatever the critics say.
It doesn't have much aroma.
In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, like many other places, New York Suffolk County faces tight times. Some 750 county employees are facing layoffs. So Suffolk County Executive Steve Levy decided last week he couldn't justify paying an 83-year-old World War II vet for a 10th year of donning his Santa suit to greet kids on Long Island. Enter the Democratic candidate running for Levy's seat in tomorrow's election. He now says he'll pay Santa's $660 holiday salary out of his own pocket. And he adds that he wishes his political opponents a very Merry Christmas. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 85 points, almost 0.75%, to close at 12,068. The Nasdaq picked up 9 points, 0.33%. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.67%. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And tomorrow on this program, how do you say crisis in Italian? Marketplace reports from Rome on the European debt drama. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.